Well, hello and welcome back to the next episode of the Tips and Tales podcast. I am your host, Robert Poe, and as per usual, I am here with trainer and author George DaCosta. How are you doing today, George?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, we got some great feedback on the last episode, so we're excited to continue our journey through the book Tips and Tales and get a bunch more tips out there. One of the other things that we had talked about is wanting to answer some questions that listeners had and wrote in. And so actually we're going to start today by answering a couple of those. The first question is actually a really great question for this time of year. You know, here in Southern Idaho, it's been pretty hot for the last month or so.
Really hot.
Yeah. In fact, wasn't there a weekend that you actually canceled a client coming in just because it was going to, I think it was supposed to be like 105, 106,
108.
Oh, there you go.
Up to 108. And yeah, I had a client coming in from out of state, and early on, I think on our first podcast, I said I was at 33 dogs and I was going to be at 34. Mm-hmm. Well, that I didn't get to 34 because I called and said, there's no sense in bringing your dog out in this heat. I canceled the whole week. Basically, I did a little bit of duck search work with a couple of dogs I'm working with for UT and UPT. And other than that, we just kind of shut everything down.
Yeah. So besides actually, I mean, just knowing those limits and not going past them, what kind of advice do you have for people as they're training their dog? And even, I mean, we're just a couple of weeks away from dove and some grouse seasons opening, and it can still be pretty hot with that. So maybe what pieces of advice would you give people that are running dogs in hotter weather?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I unfortunately have seen some really horrific stuff in my day. You know, you hunt long enough and do enough things and you get to see the good and you also get to see some of the bad. And, I've been at hunt clubs and guiding hunts and out in the fields where I've seen dogs come in almost dead and dead. And I know people who've had their dogs overheated and they were never the same. I know a guy had a dog that was getting ready for his UT test, and it was his best dog, and he worked it just a little too hard in the heat, and the dog shut down, and he said the dog was never the same. Absolutely didn't even hunt it anymore. So it can be, heat can really cause a problem with a dog if you're not careful. So a couple of things is, of course, the obvious is watch the temperature. You know, people get so excited. It's like when I talked about when you take your dog out and you've been working with it in the field and you don't shoot a bird until it points. And when it does point, you give it a reward of a bird. Then you go out to hunt and you got to be a little careful when you first start hunting because you can teach your dog to be a flushing dog. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of your responsibility, in my opinion, to know what's right to do for your dog. That's a contract that you sign. And knowing what the temperature is and keeping an eye on your dog and pulling it out of the field, if it looks like it's even getting close to getting too hot for it, I think that's your responsibility, something you have to do. So first and foremost, watch the weather. I don't like to hunt my dog when it gets about 60, 65. I really pull my dog off or hunt early and don't hunt him very long, and I hydrate the heck out of him. Mm-hmm.
You have a video actually on your YouTube channel where you talk a little bit about this too, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Well, I talk about it, and I can't tell you how many people when I'm out judging and their dog's starting to get hot, and I said, you know, take some time and give your dog water. And I can't tell you how many people, and even people who bring their dogs here, they'll go, well, my dog just won't take water. When he or she is hyped up, she won't drink. And I go, well, can I see your dog for a second and give it some water? Oh, sure. And I grab it by the collar, and there's a little pocket by there. Again, you might want to look at the YouTube. There's a little pocket that's on the side of their mouth alongside their teeth, and I stick my little squirt bottle in there, hold their collar, and once that water goes in, they don't have a choice to drink. And then after they start drinking, they realize, okay, if he grabs my collar and puts that there, I'm going to drink. And they just start drinking. So you can make your dog drink if need be. My dogs all come up to me while we're hunting a lot when they're ready for water. They just run up, tilt their head up, and know, you know, come give me, I'm coming back for you to give me water. Mm-hmm. So A few tips on that would be, one, watch the heat, watch your dog. You know, there's always another day to hunt. If you don't push your dog.
Yeah, especially early season.
Yeah. I put 25% Pedialyte, just the plain clear Pedialyte, in my water for my dogs. And that really helps. Some of the dogs that I've had to deal with that have come in overheated, one that was ready to die. I mean, it was gone. It was literally limp. I picked the dog up and used the pocket. Even while it was out, it got started to drink as I held its head up and gave it full Pedialyte. And the dog finally woke back up and we got it going and they took it to the vet and had to put it on IVs and such. But I mean, the dog was pretty much gone. So to anticipate that, if it's warm outside, I put a little bit of Pedialyte in my water, usually 20 to 25%. And I've checked with a number of vets. I know a lot of vets. Even the last clinic that we talked about, when the vet was talking about what we mentioned about the alcohol pouring over the back of the dog, all over the dog, I mentioned that I put Pedialyte in my dog's water and asked her in front of the crowd what she thought about it. And she said, no, that's great. That's great. A little bit of Pedialyte in that water is good for them. So that's one thing I do. I also every now and then I'll stop and I'll take my water and I'll wet the dog's underarms, flip open the ears, put water on their ears, on the skin part. That cools them down much faster. Hunt them for shorter periods of time, obviously, you know. I strip my dogs in the hunting season. Now, some people don't need to do that. You got a German short hair or something like that, or pointer. But with Griffs and some of the poodle pointers and some of the Brittany's and, you know, a lot of breeds that have the longer hair, I'll just take a stripping comb and strip them really well. And I think that helps. So I think that's probably the tips that I would give. I think the Pedialyte's a real good tip. Watching your dog when it works. If your dog is starting to act funny, it's probably you went too far.
Yeah.
Just be real careful. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of it sounds like just making sure to like take those early measures to prevent something from happening. And so be, proactive rather than reactive in those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Watch the weather, put some Pedialyte in your water when it's warm, wet the dog, flip open the ears and the underarms and the private areas. Don't hunt your dog as long. And then if you do run into a situation where your dog starts getting lethargic and looks like it's panting, another thing, I just thought of something. I watch my dog, and if my dog's got any white lines or any whiteness, it kind of looks like a cotton on the tongue, that dog's stopping for a while and getting some water. That's the start of its dehydration, and you can see that tongue change.
That's a good thing, because I mean, different dogs have different kind of heat tolerances. Like even between my two Griffs, my older one, she handles the heat way better than my younger one does. Like, when I'm out, that white shows up on my younger one's tongue so much quicker. And so getting her, actually learning from your video on that, the pocket on the side of the mouth was really helpful to me, because my older one will just, I could just pour water out of a Nalgene and she would drink it. Uh-huh. My younger one won't do that. And so learning that trick to, get the squeeze bottle and put that in there has been really helpful, because it's helped me get her in better shape and without, running the risk with her.
Yeah. And not only dogs, and it could be from the same litter, same breed. And then some dogs handle the heat better than other dogs in breeds. But I will say that dogs, like people, get accustomed to their area. So there are dogs that are from my litters that are down in, Texas and New Mexico and Arizona, and they deal with the heat, and they can hunt in a lot warmer weather than my two dogs could. My dogs would be dying out there and what they hunt in. So your dogs become accustomed to it, but still you need to be proactive and make sure that you're doing the right things to protect your dog. That's your responsibility. That's the contract that you sign. Mm-hmm. Having said that, if your dog starts to overheat, that tip that Alicia gave us is pour that alcohol all over your rubbing alcohol over your dog to get it cooled down. I like to put water on the ears and the inside, and don't be afraid to take it to the vet. IVs, You know, it might cost you a little bit, but they put an IV in the dog and they'll save its life. You know?
Yeah, so, yeah. And maybe even save it from having super long-term effects as well.
And that's something people don't consider. And like I said, I know many people whose dogs were never the same after overheating. It's not uncommon. Yeah. So
yeah, we want our dogs to thrive, not just survive. So
yeah, and you've heard me say this a couple of times already, that if you sign a contract, you know, your dogs and pups, they love you so much, they'll do anything for you. And I mean, literally, they will kill themselves for you out in the field. Mm-hmm. They have the drive to do it, and they have the want and need to please you to do it. And they don't know. They just keep going. It's your responsibility as that puppy's partner and companion to make sure that you protect it, whether it be caring for it for food and vaccines and stuff, but weather and heat included.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, great. Let's go ahead and move on to our next question. So this next one, somebody wrote in and wanting to know kind of what you thought about working with limited space. So they live kind of in a suburb sort of setting. They don't have close access to, you know, a big field nearby, and they don't necessarily have the time to, you know, drive 45 minutes, an hour away on a regular basis to go do training. So what kind of advice would you give to somebody who's working with not as much space as maybe you have here at the Gun Dog Ranch?
Well, I didn't always have the Gun Dog Ranch, although I had, you know, we had the ranch in Hawaii, and then I trained at different places, but there's a lot of times I've been where I didn't have space and I trained pups or dogs during the week till I could get away on the weekend or what have you. And I think that's a really good question. And I think there's a lot more that you can do than people realize. And I'll just touch on a few of those. I wrote an article many, many years ago, and it was called First Bird. And I think it was, there's nothing like First Bird. And I talked about training my dog. And at the time I was in a cul-de-sac, and I talked about training my dog out in the backyard in the flower bed with bumpers and pigeons and stuff, and all at home. And I'll go over some of those things, and then taking it out to the field for the very first time. And the dog went out there and really didn't know what it was doing. But when it got to that first bird, it all clicked, and it was amazing. And you never forget that first bird with any dog.
Right.
You know, so some of the things that you can do, and some of the things that I actually have done, is I'll use a launcher in a backyard in a pigeon. I had, some people can't have pigeons, but I had like three or four pigeons for a while in a small coop, and I'd work my dogs right in my own backyard. And we're talking, I lived in a nice house on a golf course, and I would take the dog out on a lead and hide it in a flower bed or wherever, and bring the dog up and, you know, let the dog go on point. And then the dog can't get a chase, but it can certainly point, and you can praise it. Good boy. Good girl.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then flush the bird. What I would do then, you can't shoot a bird, right? And not in the middle of the city. I would have,
you might get some calls in from your neighbors if you did that.
Yeah. So I would have a scented bumper, and I'll go into the scented bumper in a little bit. And so I'd bring my dog in and let the dog point, and then flush the bird. And as the bird was flying, I would throw a bumper at it in the air. So the dog would see the bumper going towards the bird. The bird would continue to take off, but the bumper would fall down. And it enjoyed getting the bumper anyway and was scented. So it would run out and get the bumper, and I'd give it prey. So I kind of mimicked a little bit of a bird falling.
Yeah, yeah.
You can also use a dead bird, a half-frozen bird. I do that. So you can do that type of stuff. Woe is always important, because you can bring woe into the field. So although you're limited, you can still do woe all over the place. I take a scented bumper when the dog's a pup, and I will just play with the dog. Just play with a bumper, just toss it. We're not doing, you know, forcing a fetch or anything. It becomes its toy, just like dogs have toys. And then what I'll do in the house is I will woe the dog and go down the hallway and place the bumper down in the hallway and say fetch and let the dog go get it. And then later on, I'll walk down the hallway, walk into a bedroom, Let the dog see me, put it in the woe position. This mm-hmm. helps with woe. Tell the dog to fetch, and the dog will run and go in the bedroom and find the bumper. Then I'll hide it in the bedroom where it's hard for it to find. And the dog will go around CK down. The dog will go into the room and look for it. And by the way, whenever I do this, I always say dead bird. Fetch dead bird.
Yeah. Because it helps create that differentiation between you're looking for a bird that you want to go pick up and one you want to point.
Right. And we'll do that in the field work. Absolutely. So that's a game that I play. And then what I'll do as I take my dog for a walk, and you can do this in the schoolyard, you can do it at a park, you can do it in your neighborhood. If you've got places with high vegetation, I will walk along and I'll have the bumper. And every now and then I'll just stop and toss the bumper where the dog can see it and say fetch, and just play just a couple. You don't do this a lot. And then I will walk to where the grass is tall someplace where I can toss the bumper and the dog can see the bumper fly and fall, but can't see it on the ground. And then I'll, you know, have my dog woe and send it with a fetch command to go get the bumper, and it'll engage its nose to go find the bumper in the tall grass or the mm-hmm. bushes. Mm-hmm. After I've done that a few times, I'll go for a walk and I will just toss the bumper without the dog seeing it. And then we'll come back and I'll go put the dog on woe and I'll go fetch dead bird, and I'll go find the bumper. So that transfers back out into the field later on.
Yeah.
When you're working with actually a dead bird. So I do that with the bumper. I'll work pigeons in the yard of my house. I will use the woe posts in schoolyards. I'll do a lot of mimicking what the dog will do with bumpers and a dead bird. And then I'll use a couple light pigeons now and then. There used to be a place that you could walk by my house. This was many years ago. It was a little trail, and I would just go out there with a couple of bird launchers and walk on the trail, hide them, and then go get my dog and walk down. And then they'd smell the bird and launch it and let it go. So, you can also do, now we're getting into retrieving, we're getting into a little bit more advanced stuff. You can also play the baseball game out in the park or the schoolyard. That's what I do with my dogs when I trained for the baseball when I was, you know, in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. So I hope I'm giving you.
No, that's great. One of the questions that it just as you're talking is kind of formulating in my head is a lot of the times, like that space, like the backyard is also a space that the dog has that it's just, you know, that's where it goes out and you play with it, or it has to go out to the bathroom. So is there anything in particular that you feel is like necessary to differentiate between, okay, we're just going out to like go to the bathroom or let them run around for a second, and when you take it out and you know there's a bird out there and you're trying to do some training with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you just brought something into my mind. I'm going to mention my friend Bruce Gillette, and remind me to go back to that question on verbiage. But I played that game I told you about, the hallway, about I drag the bumper down the hallway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What Bruce does, he's taken it even farther. He's got a pretty good sized backyard. And just remind me when you said the backyard, he's got a couple of dogs and he puts them on woe, and he's got a sliding glass window, and he'll go out there and he'll drag the bumper around. He'll hide it someplace, and then he'll go back inside, open the door, and then tell one of them to fetch. That's another thing you can do. If you have two dogs, you can start teaching them to have patience while the other one goes out. Mm-hmm. And the dog will run out, follow the track, find the bumper, bring it back into the house, and then he'll do it again. So it's actually a full outside game in his backyard to go find that bumper and bring it back into the house with his dogs. Mm-hmm. So that's taking it one step further.
Yeah.
And I do this verbiage that you're talking about, I do this even if I'm in a field. So I tell my clients, when we start to run their dog in the field, whatever they want to use for their dog to go in the search mode or find a bird, we do that every time we stop, get to the field, and then they'll say either hunt them up or find the bird or mm-hmm. or let's go or whatever command now you happen to use, hunt them up.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And sometimes I'll use find the bird. When I toss the bumper, I'll say find the bird, fetch. When you take your dog outside, if you're going to do some of this work, it is key that you, so I say you got one bird launcher and you're going to plant it in the bushes in the backyard. You take your dog right out the back door and you go, whoa, and you'll say, hunt him up, where's the bird? And that dog will go into that mode. It'll go into the mode of going to find the bird. So it knows, oh, it's time. It becomes a game to them, right? It's
yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
So and then you go out in the field for the first time and you go hunt them up. Let's go find the bird. Bam. The dog goes, okay, this is just a really huge backyard. And off it goes. It knows what to do. So, yes, the verbiage is key. I do the same thing with tracking when I teach tracking. We use dead bird whenever a bird hits the ground. And so in tracking, we always use dead bird. Dead bird, dead bird. Now the dog knows mm-hmm. it's time to track and not time to go into the search mode. My dog CK is just running around here. You okay, buddy?
Yeah, I'm sure that you guys occasionally will hear them laying down or walking around as we're talking. But okay, yeah, yeah. No, I think that's good. I mean, that one of the things that I do in particular, because I do have a good sized field right next to where I live, and so I'll go out, you know, and sometimes we just go out and we're running. But when I go out and we're doing like training, I have like, you know, this super old hunting vest that I don't use out in the field anymore, but I use it as like my training vest that I put that on. And especially my older one, because she's, you know, has a lot more experience with it, she sees me put that on and she like her attitude completely shifts, because she knows like, oh no, we're gonna go work, we're gonna go do something that I really yeah. like. And
yeah. yep yep
yeah. So and her, you know, whole demeanor in the field even changes, and it's the exact same field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But she knows what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another thing that I will mention on that, you heard me say that I don't teach my dog to heal until after its first year, after it's actually gone out in the field and done some stuff. I'm going to get back to that in a second, because I want to say something here, and we'll get into this in the future, is a lot of times people will ask me, when do you start doing this? When do you start doing that? When do you start teaching heal? Or when do you start doing force fetch? Or when do you do this? Or when do you do that? To me, you have to look at the experience of the dog more than the age of the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't do force fetch until my dogs got out there and had some fun and learned to love to hunt and got some birds. Now, my dogs might get 50 birds in the first 3 weeks out here playing around. Somebody else might get 5 birds a year or go out twice a year. So it's more important to know where the dog is experience-wise than it is what the age is on doing some things in the future. And we'll get into that a little bit more. What made me think about that is, you heard me say that I don't teach my dog to heal till after the first year. It's really after the dog has got out and done some pointing, got experience and learned to love to hunt. Then I'll go to heal. Before that, I keep my dog on a lead, and it could be a short lead, a 10 foot lead, up to a 20 or 30 foot lead. And I do the half hitch on my dog, and I let it walk in front of me. So when you're walking your dog on the street, on the sidewalk, around your property, a lot of people think you have to heal your dog. When I'm teaching your dog to be right next to you on the side, that's its place. I don't do that. And so you're asking what kind of things can you do if you don't have property. You still can do that. Your dog walks in front of you on the sidewalk on mm-hmm. a lead, and you tell it easy to slow down and whoa it now and then. But it learns its job is to be in front of you. Even though you're walking in the street, walking in the park, what have you, I don't yeah. heal my dog on that first year. And I let it learn the easy command. So if you look at that, and you're teaching your dog to be out in front of you, you're teaching it to slow down, you're teaching it to whoa, then you're teaching it to find a bumper, you're making it engage its nose, looking forward in some grass, some tall grass or bushes, and every now and then if you can get some pigeons, you launch a couple pigeons, bring it in for a point, even if it's in your backyard, and praise it when it points, good boy, good girl. That's mimicking a lot of the stuff that you're going to do out in the field. It's a much easier transfer if you're doing that stuff than if you're just healing your dog all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
sit and doing the basics obedience. So I hope that made sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's great. All right. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and kind of pick up where we left off last time at the book. So we got not super far, but man, it was a really good conversation. So we're going to move on to the next topic, which is the recall command. So maybe I know that you've mentioned earlier in some of our other conversations that you start, you know, super early. Like if you have a litter of puppies, kind of, you know, in conjunction with that whoa, you know, you have them in the pen, tell them to whoa, and then you let them out. But as soon as they start coming towards you, you start introducing that recall command that you use.
Yeah, all my dogs have always had a pretty darn good recall command, or actually a really good recall command, and it has not been that difficult to teach, but it starts early. And let me throw this out to the listeners there. If you think I'm speaking to you as you being a dog or a puppy, you should take that as the highest compliment possible, because I get along a lot better with dogs and I have more respect than dogs than I do a lot of people. So when I put you in the dog or puppy category, take that as a compliment, as not as me putting you down. And the reason I say that is because we mentioned last time, when I'm working with a puppy, I go from A to D, and then I just don't go to E. I back up a little bit, and mm-hmm. I'm going to do that right here. I'm going to back up for our listeners just a little bit here. And that is, we're going to do the recall command. As we spoke in the past, there's two things I think that's most important as far as obedience goes, is that's the recall command and the whoa command. If you can stop your dog anywhere and then have it come back to you, you have your dog under control. You can do almost anything. Mm-hmm. And most people, if they could have their dog whoa excellently and return to them in a recall, great. They have a better dog than most people out there.
Isn't that the truth?
So start that at a very young age with a couple different processes. But at the same time, you need to let your puppy be a puppy. So you got to have obedience in that first year. And you've got to have the dog also have its head, as we discussed. You've got to let it be a puppy. So I'm just backing up just a little bit so we can move forward on that. Mm-hmm. So, yes, now that you've got the whoa command in place, or if you started with the whoa command, you can use the whoa command to help with your recall. So meaning every time I put the food bowl down, I whoa my dog. When I let the dog go to the bowl, I'm right there waiting, and I use my recall command. Repetition creates an automatic response. Mm-hmm. So the dog is returning to me on its own to get this food, but it's also responding properly to my recall command.
Yeah, yeah. So, and with a highly positive experience with that, is I have yet to meet a hunting dog that doesn't like to eat.
Yeah. And you know what? You just hit on a really key point, and I'm going to mention this, and I'll probably mention it again, is when you do your recall command, it is of the utmost importance that every time that dog gets to you, especially when it's young, that it's a positive experience. And a mistake that I see, I'm just going to throw out this tip right here. The mistake that I see is somebody doesn't have a really good recall command in place, and they call their dog and they get their dog to get to them, and then they ream their dog. I told you to come. Now you come when I come. Then the dog's sitting right in front of them and just got to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that dog's memory is, well, when I came, I got my butt chewed out and I didn't like that. So
yeah, right.
A little bit down there, they make it even harder for the recall command. So even if your dog is not complying well, say you call it and it doesn't come, and you use something else. Hey, here. Here's another little tip that I do. So I mentioned before, if I call my dog, my young pup, twice, and I say come, and it doesn't come, and I say whatever its name is, I use puppy come for the litter. Puppy come, and it doesn't come. I change the command, because I don't want to teach it not to come to the command. Mm-hmm. So I'll start clapping my hands and say, here, hey. But when the puppy starts coming to me, now the pup decides to come, right? I can't get the pup to come. And all of a sudden the pup gets excited because I'm moving my head around, or I'm enticing it to come, and it starts running to me. That's when I say the recall command. That's when I will say, come. You know, whatever its name, puppy come, or I don't want to use my dog's name because they'll come, but, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. Fido, whatever, come, as it's on its way to me. Now, it might not have complied for a couple of times and I changed the command, but when it's actually doing the action that I want it to comply to, which is the recall command at this time, I will use that command. And when it gets to me, I will pour on the praise. Good boy, good girl, whatever the case may be. The recall command has to end with a positive when the dog complies. If you get mad at the dog or you get upset and you climb on that dog's case, when it does get to you, after a recall command, you're going to put yourself in a backwards position. You're going to step back because now the dog's got a negative when it came to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real important thing on the recall command. Make sure that it's a positive when it gets to you, regardless of what has transpired in front of that. Now, if the dog hasn't complied, you might want to put the dog on the lead after a while, 15, 20 minutes later, and make that dog come to you every time on the first command.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't do that right when it finally came to you. You make that experience positive and then wait a little bit and then go out there and implement the command and make it comply. So I do that. I use the recall command after the woe command, which we've already established. I use the recall command on a young puppy every single time it's coming to me. Any time on an 8-week-old puppy, a 7-week-old puppy, whatever, when that puppy's running over to me, if I have a wing in my hand or it's just happy to see me, I give my recall command every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Repetition creates an automatic response, right? So the dog hears that command, it's coming to me, it gets a real positive when it gets to me, and that command becomes something that it enjoys. It wants to come to me. Every time it's come to me, it's either gotten food or it's gotten praise or we had fun. It becomes a real positive.
Mm-hmm.
When I get to formal training, I'll put a lead on it to start with, and I'll give the come command, and I will tug at the dog and make it come. You know, come and tug at the dog. But I'm trying to make it positive. I'm enticing it as soon as it starts to come. That's all I really need to do. And my dogs have a really good recall command. That is, you're letting them know what you want them to do, mm-hmm. which is to comply and come to you. When they comply, you're making it very positive for them when they get to you. And it becomes something that they enjoy and they become a dog or a pup that wants to please you. So they're coming to you to please you because they're enjoying that. Now, will you hit the teenage years? Yes, you will hit the teenage years and you will have a dog that doesn't want to comply, regardless of how well you conducted yourself. Now, if you've been consistent and done the recall command repetitively with a positive response, you don't have much of a teenage years. And I'm saying that because, you know, some people don't have that dog that acts up very much, but they probably had a really good recall command the whole time. My dogs have a great command the whole time, but I will get a dog that doesn't want to come sometimes. Depending where the dog is at is dependent on when I will go to the e-caller. I mm-hmm. will go to the e-caller later on. And that's the first thing I do is I introduce a command. We'll get into the e-caller later. I teach the dog how to turn off the e-caller. But I get the dog to come with the e-collar. I get it to sit with the e-collar, and I get it to woe with the e-collar. And later on, I'll get it to heal. But it's very positive. The dog has worn the e-collar many times. The dog learns how to comply. So I will take the dog or puppy after it's been on birds, got its head, worn the e-collar. My dogs start wearing the e-collar 4 months old, 5 months old, but I don't start using the e-collar until I'm ready for it.
Yeah, yeah. Because again, you want it to have that, you don't want it to have that negative association with the collar itself.
I don't want it to be collar wise. There's many people that have collar wise dogs, and that is they put that e-collar on and then they start training. Or as soon as they start putting the e-collar on, they start e-collar work. I don't want my dog to know that the e-collar is there and makes a difference. It's been wearing it off and on during the day. I take the prongs off. It's been wearing it for 2 to 4 hours a day for weeks before we ever start introducing the e-collar. And even when I have my clients come to work with e-collar work, I tell them to do the same thing. And when we're going to introduce their dog to the recaller, I tell them to put the e-collar on an hour or two before they get here. Don't come here and put the e-collar on to start the work.
Yeah, don't do it instantly.
Yeah. So now we're getting into some e-collar tips. But generally speaking, my recall by repetition, by using a lead, by being positive every time it gets to you, by using the woe command and having it come to you, and even if you have a bird in your hand or a wing to play with, every time you can entice that dog to come to you, use your recall command, whether it be here or come or whatever you use, and then make it a positive experience when it gets to you. You'll be surprised how well your dog will recall in the future. Then when you get to teenage years, you're going to have to deal with, is it time for a knee collar or is it time for a little bit more obedience? I don't usually have much of a problem on my recalls. My dogs are really good, but they've been doing it since they were a little puppy.
You know? Mm-hmm. Well, and it's tapping into that thing, you know, letting them know that something that they're going to do anyways, you know, one of the things that, I think I kind of ran into, and I know other people have ran into, is, you know, a little puppy, you know, you get down on your knees and it's just going to run over to you typically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they, you know, they're like, oh, you know, my dog already knows how to come to me. And it's more of, no, the dog just is going to come to you because that's its age. That's what it's just going to do. And then a couple months later, the dog will never come to them when they wanted to. And it's because they didn't. I really like that tip of anytime it's coming to you, you know, if you're going to use here or come or, you know, whatever it is that you're going to use, start to, in, you know, put that on what the dog's already doing naturally.
Yes.
Help it to understand that later, you know, that this word is already what I'm doing.
Yes. Yes, yes. And they do. They relate that. And I, like I say, I do it every single time when a pup is coming to me, regardless what it is. You get home, they're running to you. You get out of wing, they run to you. You get their food, they run to you. Whatever it is that you're playing in the front room and the dog comes running to you. Whatever that dog is doing that makes it turn around and come to you, at that time, use your recall command. But mm-hmm. it's already on its way, and it will work. You'll be surprised actually how well it works. And don't miss the important part in this. You can even use a treat now and then. I don't use a lot of treats, and maybe I'll touch on that real quickly. But you can use a treat now and then. But the thing is, and you heard me say this, make it a distinct difference of when the dog complies, the reward. And when it gets to you, it's a reward when it gets to you. Good mm-hmm. boy, good girl, attaboy, some petting, get down, whatever. I'll touch on treats. I rarely use treats except for when I get to force fetch and delivery of a bird. Then I use treats. I use treats every time if I can, if the dog will accept them. A lot of people will say, well, you can get a lot accomplished with treats. And you can, and I might be repeating myself. But dogs are smart. And you've got to wonder if you're giving it a treat every time to do a command, has the dog trained you to give it treats mm-hmm. on command, or are you training the dog? So I want to mix up my reward. It might be a bird in its mouth. It might be petting. It might be a rub down. It might be a toss of the bumper. It might be a treat. It's always going to be something very positive, but it's going to be what I decide to give for the reward.
Yeah. Well, and even kind of just speaking to that real quick, my wife wanted to, like, you know, oh, I want to do just, you know, little fun training, you know, like teach the dog to shake. And, part of it was, is that she's a little bit of the sucker in our family, and she's the one who, like, oh, well, we have a banana and that's like their favorite little treat, and I just want to give them a banana. But she recognizes she doesn't want to just give it to them uh-huh. so that then they get, you know, super beggy anytime we open a banana. But so the first thing she did was teach them to shake, and for a really long time, and even sometimes now, open up a banana and they'll, you know, come and sit down in front of you and then stick their paw up.
Yeah.
Like, no, I know how I get this treat. Like, I put my paw out here yeah. and we do shake and you give it to me. So yeah. I'm going to preemptively, like, yeah, no, I want that.
Now think if she would have done the hold command instead of the shake command with that banana. Your dog would have been running to you, opening its mouth to put something in its mouth to hold mm-hmm. for that banana. You've got part of force fetch done. I write that in the book that the whole command is just like teaching your dog to shake or bark or whatever. Speak.
Yeah. Yep.
You just do it the same fun way with treats and doing that stuff. So, you know, it's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. So I hope that answered your question on the recall. That's
yeah,
basically
yeah.
what I do until we get into to doing collar work, and we'll go into collar work when we get to collar work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so. and you have another chapter later that's the advanced recall, where the collar is a big piece of that. But
yeah, we don't want to touch
yeah.
on that now.
Yeah, well, yeah, well, that'll be a ways down the road at this point.
Yeah, we want to keep everything in sequence, like yep. You know, like we talked about the dog, so people understand and go forward on it. So.
All right. Well, the next chapter that is up is sit and down.
All righty. Well, you probably heard me say that I don't use sit in my dog's first year, and I don't. I will teach the dog to sit, and you know, it's a command that's easy to learn. And I'm just going to go back again. Repetition creates an automatic response. And I tell people things, I'm going to throw this out there. Sometimes people will say, you know, I'm glad you say things over and over. Or I'm glad you repeat it in the book, because I'm out there with my dog doing something, and all of a sudden it pops in my mind. I see the sentence that you wrote, or mm-hmm. I hear you saying it because I read it so many times. So I'm going to repeat myself a number of times, and maybe in the spur of the moment when one of our listeners is out there doing something, that verbiage will just pop into their head. So this one I'm going to repeat is I don't use sit a lot to put the dog in a sitting position the first year, because I get many dogs brought to me that aren't pointing that sit on point. I mean, they will point and then they'll go down to sit. It's not, people think that's uncommon. It might be uncommon if you trained four dogs in your life and judged none or 10, but if mm-hmm. you've judged hundreds, and this year I've worked with 33 dogs, you're going to start seeing this more and more, because I get to see some of the problematic dogs, and yeah. sitting on point can be one of them. So when you teach a dog to sit, you actually apply pressure to it in some manner, whether it be pushing down on its rear, and that's a physical pressure, or holding the treat or something, that's a mental pressure. You don't get this until you sit, and then the dog sits.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very easy command to teach. The dogs get sit pretty quickly. So what I see happen many times is the dog learns to sit fairly quickly, so everybody in the family uses it. Every time you yeah. want your dog to stay still, it's sit. The kids tell your dog to sit. The wife tells your dog to sit. Somebody comes over the door, you tell your dog to sit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dog is hearing sit, 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 and what it's doing is it's taking off the pressure. It wants to go meet the person at the door, but you make it sit, so it sits, and it takes off the pressure. It wants the treat, whatever the case may be. It wants to eat. It wants to stand up, but you push on it. Again, physical pressure. So to take the pressure off, it sits down. And when it's in the sitting position, it realizes, okay, I'm just going to sit here until they release me. So then it goes on point, and the pressure's on. It has worked mm-hmm. the scent cone of a bird, and it's getting all hyped up, and the adrenaline's building up, and it gets to the bird, and it goes on point. And you want it to learn steadiness. You want it to stay on point until the bird flushes, or till you go up and flush, or maybe till the shot. So now the pressure's even building more, because you're training the dog to be a little more steady, and it starts getting driven with that. So it sits.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it happen a lot. So I will teach sit, but I don't use it a lot. I use down a lot, and I use whoa a lot in the first year, because rarely will a dog go all the way to the down position from the pointing position. But it will learn to stand in the whoa position from the pointing position, which is perfect for steadiness later on.
Mm-hmm. So because that's not really a change in its physical, like, how it is physically in that moment.
Yeah, and here's a good point. When you're judging a dog, people don't realize this. Say you're judging a natural ability dog. We'll just start with natural ability. And that dog goes on a flash point. The point's done. The dog's pointed. Once it starts moving or goes on lower stands or something, the judging on that point is done. Once that dog locks up in a pointing position, that's done. Now, when you're judging for a higher standard, you know, we'll go to UT or whatever, pointing is considered finished once the dog responds to or acknowledges the handler. So the dog is 25, 35, 40 yards away from you, 100 yards away from you, and mm-hmm. it locks on point. Now you're judging the dog. It's on point. It's on point. It's on point. It's holding very well. Looks good. Looks good. Now the handler walks alongside of it and knows the handler's there, or the handler gets close, or the handler says something. Now the dog acknowledges the handler is there. Now it's on steadiness. It's no longer, even though it's standing there on point, you're not judging the point anymore, because the dog is now on a steadiness. Mm-hmm. So doesn't matter what the body language looks like. So having your dog fall into the woe position after you're there, or acknowledging that you're there in some manner, and that could just be knowing you're there, that's a perfect position for guiding hunts, for working in a field, for testing. It's exactly, that's what you want. So I want the fail safe to be whoa. So when I teach my dog to sit, I do not push down on its rear end, because that can be hard on the joints on a dog. And you see people do this a lot. They'll tell their dog to sit and they'll literally push hard on the rear end of the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes applying a lot of pressure on that. Now, if you're going to breed your dog, you're going to probably get its hips checked at some point in time. And if you're breeding a dog and you're pushing down on its hips when they're developing at a young puppy age, those sockets are not in place yet and they're not formed completely, you could constantly... Mm-hmm. You could possibly cause some spreading of the hips in those areas and get a bad hip report. And it's
even if it genetically would not have done that, it, you know, you can kind of create it.
Yes. So I don't like pushing directly down on my dog's rear end to get it to sit. So what I do is I put my right hand, I'm right-handed, but it doesn't matter. I put my right hand on the dog's chest. So just below its neck, on its chest. And then I put my left hand, on the dog's rump. And I push backwards. And if you can picture, I don't know, when you were a kid, if you ever had somebody stick their foot behind you and somebody pushed you and you went falling backwards, and you kind of just roll back and fall down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm rolling my dog's rear end down in that manner. So I am applying pressure from the front mostly to make the dog go back. But as it starts to move backwards, I apply pressure on its rear, and the dog will roll into the sitting position instead of pushing directly down.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I have a friend of mine, Gary, who was doing that, and his dog was a little bit tough on doing that, didn't want to go down. He rolled his hand from the rear under the back of the back legs as he pushed down, again, kind of like taking the legs out. And we do that. We used to do that with horses to get horses to back up and push their back legs down. And just rolls his dog down. He showed me that technique, and I thought, oh, that's pretty good. That's just a little bit more... just a little change on the technique I was using.
Yeah, yeah.
So I roll my dog back. I'm pushing it back from the chest and rolling it down so I'm not applying pressure to the hips, and I get my dog to go in the sitting position. That's how I teach sit. And then, again, I reward it. Good dog, good boy, whatever, good girl. And if it gets up, I push it right back, and I always make sure that I release my dog from the sitting position. Just like I said, you always release your dog from woe. If it stands up and goes and starts moving around and you haven't released it, you just taught it that it can get up. You don't need sit, stay, as we said. Sit means sit until I release you.
Yeah, yeah. Again, that consistency and not making it more complicated than it needs to be.
Yep. And I do it for a very short period of time. In fact, my dogs, when they're puppies, they learn to sit for literally a few seconds, a few times, maybe 5 or 6 times. And then we're done with sit. We're moving on to down. And what I do there with down is I put my dog in the sitting position. I roll it back. And then I grab their front paws. So now I've rolled them forward, right? And they're in the sitting position. I've made them sit. And I waited a couple seconds. And then they're good. And I let them up. Okay, out or whatever. And then I made them sit and do this just a few times. And do this a few times for a few sessions. And then now they're getting sit. So now I don't even let my dogs get sit very well. I mean, I don't want them to go sit, boom. Once I get them to know that sit means roll down, then what I do is I take their front paws and their legs and I pull it forward. So now they're in the sitting position. I pull it forward and I say down. And they go into the down position because their back end's already down. Now I'm pulling their front end forward, and so they have to go down. I kind of push with my thumbs on their legs as I pull their legs forward and down. And I say down. And once they're in down position, and I'm down there with them, by the way. I squat down there with them. I say, get them to sit, and then I go down, and I go down. I push them down. Then I pet them. Good boy, good girl. Down. And I tell them down, down, because they're down. I want them to know this means down.
Yeah.
And what I'll do now and then is when they're in that down position, laying down, usually their legs are a few inches apart, I'll take a little treat and put it in between their legs on the floor. And they'll reach down there and eat that treat. Good boy, good girl. And they're staying there. So they're laying there expecting a treat now and then in between their paws.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that once in a while just as a reward for being in that down position. And I make them stay there longer and longer and longer. You know, I might start off with 5 seconds and then 30 seconds and then a minute. And then when my dogs are probably a few months old. I'm going to say, you know, by the time they're 4 months old, for sure, my dogs, I can go down and they'll just lay down. Like that dog over there has been laying down for I don't know how long. And he wants to get up. I don't know why, but he's been looking up and wanting to go. But I tell them in the down position, they go down. Now, that gives me some obedience in the first year. So I have whoa in place, right? Mm-hmm. They know sit, but I don't use it very much. I have my recall command in place, and I have the down position now in place. So if I'm going to make my dog stay in one place, and a lot of times I'll, if I'm going to the store and I know I can see my dog just for training, I will, I don't know where that is, but I will.
Oh, it's over on the kennel over there.
Okay. I will, do you want to turn that off or turn the mic off? I will place my dog in the down position and keep it there longer and longer and longer. And when I will go into a store, sometimes I'll just go into the store, and if I can see the dog, I will place the dog in the down position where I can see the dog outside of a glass window or something, and I can watch the dog, and I'll walk, and you can do this in your house too. I start from the house and I walk into the store or walk into your house, look in the sliding glass window. And if the dog stands up, I go right back outside and put it in the down position. And I'll do that longer and longer. And pretty soon you can put your dog in the down position and go anywhere, and that dog will just stay right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I teach down. Again, you just elongate it more and more time. So now in that first year, I have whoa, whoa, and that dog remains standing wherever it's at. I have easy, and the dog slows down. I have down, and the dog goes into the down position and remains there. I have sit if I need to use it. I have my recall command come. I've got a dog that can do a lot of stuff in a lot of places well under control. And so those are my basic commands that I'm using. And if you think about it, I get this all the time. You have watched somebody with a dog, and they say the dog's out in front of them, and they say easy, and that dog slows down and stays right in front of them. They say whoa, and that dog stops. And they say out, and the dog starts moving. And they say come, and the dog comes to them. And they go over and say down, and the dog lays down and stays in its place. People look at that and go, wow, that dog is a really well-mannered dog.
My dogs, they don't have all those perfectly all the time, but way more than a lot of my friends. And so, I mean, most of my friends are like, gosh, you have such good dogs. And I'm like, I mean, they just follow basic commands. That's all they do.
That's all there. And they're not, you're not healing the dog, you know, and the reason is because it's a puppy. We will get into healing, and you're not putting that dog in the sitting position. So we're trying to remember we said earlier on in the last episode, that it's much easier to train a dog correctly than it is to fix a problem later on.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there's many dogs out there that can sit and they won't sit on point. And there's many dogs that you can teach to heal and they'll still search fine. But if we can circumvent those problems in the future that have potential to be a problem, it's way easier, because if they do develop that problem, it's a hard job to now go and fix it. So, so the commands that we do have, put your dog in a really good, obedient manner. It'll come to you. It'll stop and stand anywhere. It'll go to the down position. It'll slow down in front of you. That's a very well-mannered dog. And we've done everything that we'll do in the field if we need to. If you stop in the field for a rest, tell your dog down.
Mm-hmm.
If you want your dog to slow down, you tell it easy. If you want it to stop, you say whoa. If it goes on point, you want to stay steady, you say whoa. So all the stuff that we're doing in this obedience is stuff that we actually will use in the field at times.
Yeah.
So we have got an obedient dog that is also being a puppy. And we're not so obedient doing things that will be handler dependent and maybe affect the way it works in a search or in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Alrighty. Let's move on. I think we'll get one more topic in here, which I believe this next chapter is the learning through the process of osmosis. So we mentioned it a couple times in the last one. Maybe dive into what you mean by that and what, like, yeah, why that's an important thing to be mindful of.
That's probably one of my favorite things to talk about, maybe chapters in the book, is the process of osmosis, because we just listed things that we train for. We train for woe. We train for the recall. We train for down. We train for sit. And we can do all that in the manner of formal training as well as repetition throughout the day. Process of osmosis and the easy command is kind of a process of osmosis. But what it is, if you think about it, it is like a child learning its native language. You're not sitting down with a child during the day, every day, when it's a little baby and an infant and starting to grow up, and saying, okay, this is how you say have, and this is how you say this, and this, and this is how you make a sentence. Mm-hmm. You're just talking. You're just doing stuff. You might be doing some baby talk, but you're talking. And pretty soon that child starts picking up some words. Pretty soon it starts forming a sentence. And pretty soon the child starts talking. And you didn't send it to school to talk. You didn't sit there and do formal education. Mm-hmm. It just learned the language by osmosis, by listening, watching, repeating, and doing it. There are a ton of things that dogs learn by the process of osmosis. And the one thing to do is just to be consistent at it. My dogs know the out command really well. If I say out, boom, they go right out in front of me every time. And I that is completely by the process of osmosis. And I'll tell you, remind me to tell you about the one dog that didn't want to swim. So what does that mean? That means whenever I woed my dog at the front door before it could go out, I said out. That's what this command was, to go in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I did that before it went out of the car. Whenever I wanted the dog to move out in front of me, I used the out command. The dog just learned that out meant go in front of you. And that's a real, I can stop my dog anywhere and go out, boom, out it goes in front of me. And that was never taught in formal training. That was completely taught by just repetitiveness throughout the day, every day, by the process of osmosis. I had a pup one time that didn't like the water, didn't like bumpers. Just didn't like the bumpers, didn't like water. Mm-hmm. And so I got it used to water and we'll get to that chapter, by walking around in the water, walking through it so it could just get comfortable walking in it. And then I got to work with walk across from one side to the other. Then I got it to work and swim across. But it was doing it to be with me. It wasn't doing it because it wanted to go in the water. You know, mm-hmm. It didn't like water and didn't have confidence in it. And pup ended up being fine in the water later on. So I had to NA that dog. And it didn't care for bumpers. It wasn't a dog that I had to play with. It was a dog I was working with. But we did the out command all the time with that dog. And so in order to get it to go in the water, I walked right to the edge of the water, had the dog right alongside of me, and tossed the bumper. Your dog doesn't have to retrieve the water, and the bumper just has to swim. Mm-hmm. And I just said, out. And the dog started to walk out, and I said, out, out. And the dog went out and swam in the water. I called it back, tossed another bumper. I said, out. The dog's kind of walking. I said, out. And it just went out till it was swimming, out, and out it came back. That also comes into play later on when you want to work with retrieves and getting your dog farther out there. So the mm-hmm. out command is a process of osmosis. There's tons of other commands. For instance, one is when you're walking in a field, and whenever I have clients, whenever my dogs, when we're walking in the field, if my dog or pup is running to the right or left and it can see me, I will stick my hand out to the right or left, whatever direction it's going, and I will kind of walk in that direction. So we'll say we have a dog that's out in front of you, and all of a sudden it decides, and it's on the left-hand side, and it decides to run to the right side of the field. Or you start walking to the right, and the dog starts running in front of you to be with you, going from left to right. I will stick my right hand out straight as the dog's going right anyway. And as it passes me, I'll go this way, this way. The dog's already going that way, and it's already running to the right, and it sees my hand out. I do that every time we're out in the field when it's young. And later on, all I got to do, my dog could be anywhere. I could stick my hand out to the right or left and go this way, and that dog goes straight right or left. I have a lot of people who have looked at me with a young puppy, and we're working a field, and say we're going close to private property or someplace I don't want the dog to go, or we're getting close to somebody else's dogs that I don't know, and I'll go, hey, this way, and I'll point my hand straight out to the right, and I got a little puppy, turns around and runs to that side, and they're like, how did you teach that? well, I didn't really teach that. The dog kind of was doing it anyway. I just did the command. Mm-hmm. So that process of osmosis is saying a command that the dog is already doing and repetitively doing that as it's growing up. And now it applies that command or that motion to that act, and it just learns it all on its own.
Mm-hmm. Which actually is essentially how you teach your recall command with puppies.
That's part of the recall.
It's a piece of it. It's the kind of that foundation that you end up laying, you know, you're coming towards me, I'm giving you the command.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So that part of it would be the process. Now, a lot of times, mm-hmm, I woe the dog and then have him come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Me
there, yeah. It's, there are, so. There's the formal piece of it where, right, you know, you'll have it on a lead or you'll woe it. And,
yeah.
But,
yep.
But, yeah. Yeah. But you start early on with that osmosis piece that really sets up those formal pieces really well.
Yeah. A couple other ones that I do, and there's more in the book. I mean, you can look at the book and pick some up, but just a couple other ones that you heard me say that when I toss a bumper, I always say fetch. And some people, you say, you can't use fetch because you're going to use fetch when you get to force fetch. I don't. I use the hold command. I still use fetch, but I use fetch all a puppy's life. Anytime it's running out to grab something, it could be its toy, it could be a wing, it could be a bird, it could be a bumper. When it's running out to grab something, I'll say fetch. Because later on, when I say fetch and we get into actually doing retrieves, it already, mm-hmm, knows fetch means goes out. Go out and get it or go out to it. Now, I might have to work on hold and have it retrieve and bring it all the way back, but that's later on. But I say fetch every time the dog goes out to grab a bird. We shoot a bird and the dog runs out to it, whether it brings it back to me or not. When it's headed out to it, we're saying fetch. The other, mm-hmm, thing that I say is every time when you shoot a bird, and you're working with the dog, and it lands in the field. Sometimes you can see the bird. Doesn't matter if you can see it or not. Your puppy is going to run towards that bird. They all do. Whether they pick it up and carry it or bring it back is another story. But they're all going to run to that bird that you just shot. Every time it gets close to the bird, when it takes off, I yell fetch. When it gets to the area that the bird has fallen into, I say dead bird every single time. Mm-hmm. Dead bird, dead bird, dead bird. So what happens later on as the dog grows up, when you down a bird, you say dead bird, it knows exactly what to do. It's done it every time. It means get my head down. There's a dead bird here. It doesn't even have to see the bird. It learns that when you say dead bird,
yeah,
there's a bird on the ground. I use dead bird when I start my track. So when you're testing for natural ability, you want your dog to track. Well, when we go into the field, we talked about this a little earlier, I will use hunt 'em up. Right? Hunt them up to get them going. Mm-hmm. I don't use hunt them up or find it or whatever. When I get to the track, I put my hands down. I go dead bird, because every time that dog has gone and looked for a bird and had to smell it, knew that the bird was here someplace, it saw it fall.
Yeah.
It engaged its nose on the ground to locate it. I said dead bird. So now I start my track and I start tapping the ground and I say dead bird, that dog's nose goes down to the ground because it knows there's a dead bird here. It hits the track and it follows the track.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few other ones in there, probably in the book. I can tax my memory here and try to find more, but you can teach your dog way more commands with the process of osmosis than you can with formal training in that first year. Many more commands, and it's just by doing it repetitively, doing it when the dog's doing it, or adding it to something that the dog is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a child learning its natural language, that dog will associate that command with what it's doing and it will learn it on its own. So great training tool, I'll tell you.
Well, and it probably one of the things that it's, to me, as I'm thinking about it, just creates a lot of value in understanding that and being mindful of that and intentional with that on your end, is it just makes it so you have to use so much less pressure for anything. And it helps me make it a little bit more fun because the dog's like, oh, I'm already doing this. I'm doing a good job just being who I am as a dog.
Yep. Yep. And it learns it without any pressure. I'm going to tell, here's a really good tip right here for people who travel with their dog and go out places. When I take my dogs out and we're traveling, we're driving, or they go out of the house, I tell my dogs, go potty, and they go potty right away. They, mm-hmm, go out and if I jump out of the car and I walk to an area and I go potty, my dogs are going potty right then.
Mm-hmm.
And people are amazed by that. Why? every time when they were a pup and they started to go potty, I go, go potty, go potty. Mm-hmm. When they were taking a leak, it was go potty, go potty.
Yep.
So now when I'm traveling, I go outside and I go potty, they go potty.
They have an understanding like, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do and right here, right now in this place, even if I've never been here.
All by the process of osmosis. Mm-hmm. All by the process of osmosis. And I do that to this day when I go to bed at night and I need my dogs to go to the restroom. I open the door, I walk outside. Now, they don't know I'm going to bed, right? Because I go to bed all different hours. They mm-hmm. might just go out and play. I walk outside and I go potty, and they both run around, go potty, and then we go in and go to bed. So that's a good process of osmosis, one that it's a great tip for somebody that travels. I travel all over the United States driving. I'll be headed to Montana in a few weeks, and then I'll be going to Arizona. I'll be going to Oklahoma. I'll be going to Kansas. And so when you're traveling in the car, get out of your car. Mm-hmm. Strange place. Tell my dogs to go potty. Boom, they go potty.
Yeah, a lot better than waiting, 20, 30 minutes or risking a dog that just can't hold it anymore in the back.
Yeah, and also it stops them from wanting to go. It's amazing, but it stops them from wanting to go sniff all over the whole countryside before they go potty and maybe mm-hmm. go look at this dog or that person, whatever. When I say go potty, they just run out there and go potty.
Yeah.
And again, don't want to go over that on my time. Just I was thinking about that when I thought that's a pretty cool one that people look at me and go, that was cool. But it was totally process of osmosis.
Yeah. So, yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, that's good stuff. I think that'll wrap up this episode. So in the next one, we'll get into intro to birds and gunfire. Yeah, just want to thank everybody for listening. We've gotten some great feedback and some good questions. So don't forget, if you have a topic or a question, especially as you're listening to an episode, you're like, oh, I have a question on what you said about this. You can write into the Tips and Tales podcast at gmail.com. And that may show up in a future episode. And again, if you have your wherever you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe so that whenever an episode comes out, it automatically pops up for you. And if you could leave a rating or a review or something, that for a lot of the different platforms, that helps other people find the podcast. So if this has been really helpful to you, make sure to do that so that other people can find us. And don't forget, as always, as George says in his book, blessed are the men and women who live with a bird dog by their side. Have a great day.